Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. The attack on Moscow's Crocus City Hall on March 22nd left more than 140 people dead. There are many questions about what happened, especially about the suspects Russian authorities apprehended, seven of whom are ethnic Tajiks and allegedly members of the Islamic State of Khorasan Province terrorist group. However, there is no question that by accusing Tajiks of carrying out the attack, Russian authorities unleashed a wave of not just anti-Tajik sentiment, but anti-Central Asian sentiment in Russia. Several million Central Asians are migrant laborers in Russia, and there are tens of thousands at least more Central Asians who have acquired Russian citizenship and been living in Russia for years. Many Russians now view them with suspicion and even hostility. So to discuss what's been happening in the last week, I am joined by Edward Lemon, professor at Texas A&M University and the president of the Oxus Society for Central Asia, and Salim Jan Ayob, director of Arafirel's Tajik service known locally as Azadi. Edward, I'm going to start with you. So we got to set the table here. Can you describe the conditions for Central Asians working in Russia? What sort of work do they usually do? What are their living conditions like? How are they viewed by the Russian people and by the Russian government?
I think in general, life for many of the migrant laborers from Central Asia in Russia is quite difficult. They live often in crowded quarters, often sharing apartments with sometimes up to a dozen people sharing, you know, a one-bedroom apartment in some cases. Many of them, because they are undocumented, have issues with their employers sometimes who often withhold pay from them. They often work without labor contracts, and so they have limited rights. Many of them, as a result of their undocumented status, have issues accessing healthcare and are susceptible to police corruption. So many of them are working in positions in the construction industry, in agricultural, in the agricultural sector, in areas such as domestic work, in the case of particularly women migrants from Central Asia. And so in general, they're viewed by Russian people as something of an underclass, as a group that isn't on an equal footing with the ethnic Russian and the Russian population. And there's a great degree of xenophobia and stigmatization of the whole community. So there's a great degree of anti-migrant sentiment in the country, you know, that we've seen increase since the attack, as you noted.
Okay, thank you. Salim Jan, what is your service hearing from migrant laborers in Russia right now? And also, what is the reaction of the people in Tajikistan to the attack?
So we have been receiving a lot of reports that the level of xenophobia and it's really rising. We have been receiving reports from different parts of Russia. As you know, Russia is a huge territory, and in Tajikistan also, the families of the migrants are very worried. Some of them even just crying and understanding what happens to their relatives, sons in Russia. However, I can't say that it's everything is too bad. For example, just before leaving the office today, I read a message from one of my friends who is doctor in Russia. And I should add to what Edward said. Yes, most of them are living in those conditions that Edward described. However, some part of them, and this process was at the very beginning, at the very start, you know, some of them started becoming part of the society, Russian society, making some successes in different areas. And for example, in medicine, there are a lot about 35,000 doctors in Russia who migrated from Tajikistan. And it was a special program by Russian authorities. They started looking for best doctors, nurses, and inviting them and promising them good conditions and so on. And this doctor wrote that, look, last night, I was very scary and I was thinking, if should I go to work this morning? And finally, I decided to go there. And when I entered the hospital, all the doctors, all the many nurses, so different nations, Russians, other nations came and hugged me and said that we understand in what kind of emotional situation you are, and we will support you. We do not think that all the Tajiks are terrorists and things like this. So maybe it's just one or two this kind of cases, but you know, it adds some more color to what is going on in Russia. Yeah, of course. On the very first day, we received a report that three young men were beaten by a mob, and one of them hospitalized. So a lot of negative. And today, overall, maybe around 100 Tajik migrants were not allowed to enter Russia. They were sent back to Tajikistan. And now the planes are coming to Dushanbe and Bokhtar. And in Dushanbe, our journalist is waiting for them at the airport to hear what happened to them. Because neither Russian nor Tajik authorities comment that what is going on with them.
What is state media reporting about the attack in the week since it's happened? Did they cover it?
Only official reports that are going through Russian media. Nothing more. But at the same time, some very nationalistic shows is going on the TV, and it's looking like the state media is using this opportunity to strengthen Tajik state narrative about the civil war, about the opposition groups. So they are saying that, look, this is what our leader of the nation warned Russia and the whole world many, many times, many, many years, and no one listening to him, no one hearing him. And now you can see what happened. So, and this, our leader saved our country, imprisoning those people, those kind of people, or exiling them or sending them out of the country, like Islamic Revival Party, Group 24, and others, and so on. So it's kind of, no real news, no concrete facts, but mostly propaganda based on those news stories, the propaganda that to show the people that the Rahmon's government is doing very well and nothing happening is in Tajikistan, nothing like Krokus in Tajikistan. That's because the government is doing very well. So, yeah, this kind of reports on state media.
Okay, thank you. Edward, this is potentially really harmful for not just the image of Tajiks, but financially too. Remittances are a big part. Remittances from Russia are a big part of Tajikistan's economy. Can you speak a little bit about that and what's at stake here?
According to World Bank figures from 2023, Tajikistan's economy was, or 48% of Tajikistan's economy was dependent on remittances sent back from migrant laborers in Russia, primarily. And so it is one of the most migration-dependent countries in the world. It's around $5 billion of remittances coming back in, which basically keeps the economy afloat. There are something like officially 1.3 million, depends how one measures migration, but between 1.3 and 2 million Tajiks living or spending part of their year in Russia and often working there. And so that's a very large part of the labor force. So certainly, should there be restrictions or a decrease in migration to Russia, that would have a negative effects on the economy back home in Tajikistan. And of course, if we see lower levels of migration, then we would also see a large group of unemployed people, mostly younger men who would be back in Tajikistan without any likelihood of finding a job.
Okay, thanks. Selim John, this is kind of a strange position for the Tajiks to be in. If we go way back, Russia, for instance, has been recruiting Tajik citizens to be members of the 201st Division that's stationed in Russia. And based on the success of that program, whereby the Tajik citizens could serve in the 201st in Tajikistan, but as part of the Russian military. And in exchange, they would get fast-track citizenship. They could become citizens and leave after that and go to Russia. That policy has been extended to other countries in the CIS too, where they can come and join. But, for like 20 years now, Tajiks have been joining the Russian military and going in and serving with Russian forces, including some presumably in Ukraine right now. Can you give a little bit about the history of the interaction between Russia using Tajik citizens and taking them in to Russia as citizens, as Russian citizens?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yes, the whole line of this started, of course, from the Russian 21st Division in Tajikistan, and now Russian 21st Base, military base, the biggest base landed on the land. And year by year, they started recruiting more Tajiks to this army and then giving them opportunity to move to Russia after some time and then to have all the benefits that Russian military officers entitled by regulations, by the law. Yeah, and a lot of them, officers, and for example, it was one time when we tried to do a series of the reports about Tajiks, successful stories of Tajiks around the world. And in Russia, I already talked about the doctors. On this, probably on the second place are militaries or security officers and so on. And they successfully entered the Russian business and made a fortune. At least we counted more than 200 very successful businessmen who made more than $1 million. When the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started in 2022, of course, a lot of officers were sent to the war. And yesterday, there was a video that a group of them, about 30 men in a military uniform, they made a statement about the Crocus attack, and of course they condemned it, and they also told the audience that they are defending Russian interest in Ukraine, they are fighting, and many of them are dying and so on. But probably, as we know, that Islamic recruiters are recruiting marginalized migrants. So those militaries, they are doing very well job recruiting Tajiks for sending them to war in Ukraine. And you said presumably in Ukraine. No, we have hard facts. We have a lot of facts that, of course, part of them were sent to war by Prigozhin, by Wagner, but another part, and quite a big part, was sent to the war by those militaries. And many of them acquired Russian citizenship, And they say Russia is our homeland and we should defend it and so on and so forth. And Russia is using those examples to propagate the idea among migrants to be part of Russian army for the receiving speedy Russian citizenship and all the benefits.
Thank you. Edward, Russia's relationship with Tajikistan could be called probably the most reliable relationship it has with any of the Central Asian states. I mean, historically, if you look at that. So is that a fair thing to say? I mean, you know, the Tajik government never criticized Russia for Ukraine. In fact, Tajik government doesn't criticize Russia really for anything except for those comments Rahman made a little more than almost a couple of years back in Kazakhstan. I mean, they never say anything bad about Russia. So is it fair to say that Russia has a reliable partner in Tajikistan, in Central Asia with Tajikistan?
I think Russian-Tajik relations have been very close. Obviously, Rahman and Putin enjoy a personal friendship. In fact, they're born 2 days apart from one another. They're both born in the same year in different parts of the then Soviet Union, and, you know, Russia and Tajikistan have close economic relations, we said, through migration, through trade, through Russian investments in the country. And in general, as you say, they've got a close political relationship. Rahman has not criticized Russia's war on Ukraine. In fact, state media doesn't even really acknowledge that there's anything going on there, that a war's even taking place. And the two have enjoyed very close relations. And so they've also enjoyed close relations between the intelligence services. And we've already seen that cooperation bearing fruit as in the immediate aftermath of the attack, when we've already seen, close intelligence sharing and even Russian operatives coming to Tajikistan to interrogate some of the family members of the attackers. So certainly the relationship is very close, and it's important also to Russia. Tajikistan's one of the few countries where Putin can travel. It was his first trip outside of the country after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 was to Turkmenistan and Tajikistan. And so it's really a place for Russia to avoid global isolation.
Okay, thank you.
If I may to add my 50 cents. You are completely right, Edward. But the relationship was not the same all the time. It was time when Russia was looking for someone else, when the relationship between Tajikistan and Russia were in a kind of, especially when Medvedev was the president and then Putin came back. So it was time, I remember how the Russian well-known journalist Orhan Jamal wrote an article based on some sources inside of the Russian government and even in their circle of Putin, that they should find new Rahman. And it was difficult time for Mr. Rahman. And it was also the period when Russia was looking to migrants completely differently. For example, there was a leader like Karamaz Sharipov or others. And I remember Karamaz made a speech sounding like Martin Luther King's speech, I have a dream, one day all the Tajik migrants come back to Tajikistan and use their talents, skills to build the best nation in the world, or thing like this. And it was interesting time, and Rahman was at some point even hopeless that he will stay, he will continue keeping his position. But then everything started changing. So we don't know how he succeeded in doing that, in turning all the things back to normal. And even you remember maybe at some point Rahmon visiting Tajikistan, not amid, Putin visiting Tajikistan, his meeting with Rahmon was not in the venue of the Tajik government, but at the club of the 21st Russian military base. And at this meeting, Putin handed a picture of Rahmon when Rahmon was a soldier of Russian or Soviet flot in Far East. And also he said that people should remember how Rahmon came to power or something like this. So those times, that period was very, very difficult period for Rahmon and for his entourage. And so, I mean, the relationship was not all the time like that, but probably because it's difficult to say how Rahmon succeeded in fixing the relationship, but now we have a very close and very warm and very probably sincere relationship.
Okay, thank you. I want to remind that we're talking about the recent spike in xenophobia in Russia, focused on Central Asians in the wake of the horrific attack on the Crocus City Hall complex in Moscow. And my guests are Selimjan Ayob, the director of RF Aerel's Tajik service, known locally as Azadi, and Edward Lemon, professor at Texas A&M University and the president of the Oxus Society for Central Asia. Edward, there's a lot of confusion about the suspects that they've arrested in Russia right now. But one of the old lines that's coming up is the fact that, you know, that Central Asia is fertile ground for terrorism. And, you know, and people, Russians are looking suspiciously at every Central Asian now, like they've come out of the, you know, like they came out of Afghanistan or something almost. Is there any evidence to support the fact that people in Central Asia are radicalized there in Central Asia and show up in Russia? I mean, or where does this radicalization take place and by what means?
I think we should avoid kind of framing the region as a hotbed of terrorism or a fertile ground for recruitment. Yes, we've of course seen maybe between 8 and 10,000 Central Asians joining terrorist organizations, primarily in places like Syria and Iraq over the past decade or so. But of course, within a region of about 70 million people, that's a pretty small number, certainly. Tajiks have maybe played a disproportionate role in terms of the number of people being recruited and the role they've played in international terrorist organizations, including Islamic State of Khorasan Province in recent years. But, you know, I think we have to put into perspective that, you know, most Central Asians do not have any interest and they do not condone and they actively are against terrorism. And as you alluded to, much of the recruitment, in fact, has taken place outside of the region, primarily in migrant communities in Russia. And so particularly, you know, estimates vary, but somewhere in the region, about 80% of those Tajiks who've been mobilized to violent extremist organizations in the past decade have done so in migration. And so certainly, on the one hand, that's natural insofar as most working age men between the age of 20 and 40 from Tajikistan live and work in Russia, as I already mentioned. But at the same time, I think migration does have a key role. The conditions they face make their lives very difficult and generate certain grievances and make the appeal of joining a terrorist organization and finding a different kind of life perhaps more tempting. At the same time, migration breaks connections with the often with relatives and friends at home. We see that having happened with some of the reporting from Radio Azadi on the suspects in the Krogos Hall attack. You know, they'd lost connections with their family. Their family didn't seem to were very shocked at what happened. They don't seem to have expected this to happen, and they don't seem to have had a background in violence, and so something obviously happened to them in migration that pushed them in this direction. And I think, you know, migration matters insofar as there are much more sophisticated networks of recruiters and logistical networks to facilitate terrorist attacks or facilitate Central Asians going to places like Syria and Iraq in Russia. So I think for those different reasons, migration has played a role in increasing the vulnerabilities to joining terrorist organizations. But I think it's ultimately a very small minority of people who've done so.
Thank you for clarifying that. That's an important point to make. Salim John, it would be almost impossible for someone to become radicalized inside Tajikistan, right? I mean, they've really put a lot of restrictions and a lot of surveillance on these people in the last few years. Isn't that true? On all Muslims, really, in Tajikistan.
Yes, but anyway, all of them are coming from Tajikistan. And their childhood, their the period of growing up is happening in Tajikistan, not in Russia. Of course, in Russia, they will just find confirmation. Or now not only in Russia, but on social network, on the internet, they find. Okay, let me just simply. Say that, for example, one young man, if we pay attention to their age, most of them are starting from 18 and to 35 or something like this. So young people. All right. So they were born after civil war in Tajikistan, as now the Tajik propaganda is saying that, look, the civil war made people like that. However, they were born after the civil war, but what they have seen around themselves in Tajikistan, on the one side, very rich people, of course, those who have either who are in the government or close to the government or close to Rahmon's family, very rich. You can find the newest model of car in Tajikistan. You can find the newest model of dresses or whatever. But on the other hand, they see corruption. They can't do anything. Starting from the school, they are paying. They are paying teacher. They are paying the director. They are paying everybody. So, and asking parents to give them money to pay for notebooks, for books, for the gift for the teacher, for everything, for renovation of the school and so on. Then at the university, either they can see if they are young Einstein, even they can't be admitted at the college, but this other guy with no knowledge about simple things will graduate from university. Then about the job, this guy will never find any good job, good paid job to make a savings and to build his life or to travel or to marry and so on. But a group of people, a small group of people from a particular sphere or let's say layer of the society, they have everything. They will not come to the university, but they will graduate and then become either deputy minister or minister or whoever. So they decide to go to Russia for the migration. What they can see there, they witness a lot of things that make them, with very hard hearts. They can see a lot of discrimination. They will not be paid on time or in full, and so on. And they will be beaten in some street or cafe and so on. So what do you want? So, of course, they're very easy to be radicalized, to be recruited by those people who are masters of recruitment. And in general, I can say that maybe education, poor education. The level that the educational system in Tajikistan is in ruins. It's nothing. It's given nothing. It neither secular nor religious. And then, of course, but during their life in Tajikistan, they will learn something from neighbors, from the villages, mullahs, that Islam is this, Islam is that. Okay, do this and do not do that. But there are general knowledge, because they can't, until 18, they can't go to mosque. But after 18, they should work and earn money. So again, they will go to Russia, not to mosque. But the internet. So the internet helps them to understand a lot of things about their religion. And the third thing is health. You know, since the Civil War, about 85% of newborns have some medical problems, especially in terms of nervous system and so on. And of course, their parents who witnessed the Civil War, of course, they also have some mental issues. So in general, and there is no good healthcare system. As I said, all the, if you are a doctor and you understand this is this kind of medication and this is another kind of medication, so you will run from Tajikistan, you will run to Russia, because Russia will provide you with the housing, with the good payment and with everything. So, and as a result, there is no good healthcare system, no good education. And a lot of religious restrictions. So what do you want? Of course, this young guy, when will he come to Russia and he will meet a new imam at the Novokuznetsk Mosque, who gave him a lot of knowledge, a lot of literature and so on. And by the chance, he will say him that you need to go to fight for our common religion and so on. So this is the what Tajiks have today, unfortunately.
Thank you. You know, that brings me to another point. I know that we're getting short on time, but it used to be for a long time, you know, from the late 1990s and for about 20 years after that, that when you heard about Islamic militants that came out of Central Asia, they were almost surely Uzbeks, ethnic Uzbeks, right? And they were in Afghanistan, they were in other places. But you start to see, and I understand that the Tajik militant group, Jamaat Ansarullah, was already active in the latter part of the first decade of this century too. But since 2014, 2015, when the Tajik government really started to crack down on Islam inside the country and eventually banned the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, after that, that's when you start to see some of the Tajiks pop up in some of these other places too. Is this just a coincidence that the government banned a legitimate moderate Islamic party, and that after they managed to ban them and declare them extremist, then we see that people's knowledge of Islam, since they don't have anything to compare it to except for just the state's version of it, is that helping to lead them astray, or is it just a coincidence that the campaign happened and after that the Tajiks started showing up in these groups? And I want both your opinions on this, actually. So Salim John, if you understood the question, could you comment on that? Was it a coincidence, the religious crackdown and Tajiks starting to join these groups, or do you think that everyone was hurt by the fact that there wasn't an alternative explanation and interpretation of Islam for them to hear, so that then when they heard other versions, they could compare it with a broader view of Islam?
Bruce, it's difficult to say for sure that it's that because of the ban on the IRPT, level of extremism or terrorism is rising. Of course, it has some impact, because when this party was legal, having own people in the parliament, and of course part of those young people were calm, were satisfied at least that they have some way to go, you know, there is some something that can represent their idea, their wishes, and so on. But of course, not only that, because you know, during the last decade at least, Rahmon's regime became more more hardline about everything. You know, many years ago, they have been arresting people with the extremist ideas, but now they can arrest whoever saying that why there is no electricity in the city. You know, the woman who interviewed by Ozodi, she said, look, is it Dushanbe? Is it center of Tajikistan? If we are living in this kind of condition, so how other peoples are living in remote areas? So she was fined for 10,000 somonis because of just saying that, you know. And we have Daleri Momali, Abdullah Gurbat, and a lot of journalists and bloggers who are completely innocent, but they are imprisoned for telling the truth. So, and this is one thing. And the second thing is that we remember the terrorist act in Kerman in Iran, but and in Shiraz in the Shah Charagh Mosque. However, we were not able to identify those people. They are Tajiks, but we don't know them. We were not able to find their family members, their native places. And several other names came from Afghanistan who were killed in Afghanistan by Taliban. Again, we were not able to find the names. So I suspect that most probably they are Tajiks, are not from Tajikistan. Because after the civil war, a group of young Tajiks, families and kids remained in Pakistan, decided not to return to the country. And most probably those people we were not able to identify are born in Pakistan, in North Waziristan, and grown up together with the Uzbek militants from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan and so on, and then they moved inside of Afghanistan. We don't know. So it means it was difficult. It was completely impossible to identify them. So that shows me that probably the rising number of those incidents is not only something related only to migration, only to situation in Tajikistan, but maybe wider, maybe that include more deeper and different aspects.
Okay, thank you. Edward, you know, I want to ask you this question too. You know, it's true of any knowledge that you're looking for. You ask one person, they give you an explanation. You ask another person about the same topic, and they give you slightly different explanation, and gradually you get a better sense of what's going on here. Do you see any connection between the fact that a group that was legal in Tajikistan for a long time was able to explain religion one way, as opposed to what the state version of Islam was all about? Does that play any role in this? And remembering too that the most famous Tajik militant from the Islamic State or ISIS was of course Gulmurad Halimov. Who was for a while the Minister of War until he was killed. And he, when he left and defected from Tajikistan's interior ministry, he said it was because of the crackdown on religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very difficult, as Selim John said, to say this is a causal relationship. Certainly we see a correlation, and obviously the banning of the Islamic Renaissance Party was part of a broader approach to counter-extremism in the country. That really is more about authoritarian consolidation and governance than it is about combating a genuine terrorist or extremist threat, as Selim John said. You know, all sorts of journalists, critics of the government, obviously members of the main opposition party that was banned in 2015 and declared a terrorist organization. You know, these are individuals who are not for the most part, supporting violence. Their behavior doesn't fit with any kind of definition of violent extremism or terrorism that we would have, for example, in the United States. And really, this is more about cracking down on different forms of potential opposition. And this is extended, as you mentioned, to religious communities. You know, we have legislation to make it very difficult to study Islam abroad. All the madrasas in the country have been closed. There are obviously bans on children under 18 praying in mosques, and then there are more informal campaigns against people with beards and hijabs, where they're forced to remove those by the police. And so, you know, I think this matters in at least two ways. Kind of as we've already mentioned, these are grievances that are picked up on in the messaging. When you look at ISKP's messaging or Jamaat Ansarullah's messaging, they're saying, why would you live, in this non-believer regime? The government of Emir Malik Rahman is waging a war on Muslims, you know, and that's certainly something that they try and use in their recruitment strategy to try and pull on these grievances. And then I think second, you know, as we've already mentioned, coupled with the education system that Salim John says doesn't really give anyone any capacity in critical thinking, the restrictions on Islamic education mean most people don't have a strong knowledge of Islam, which makes them in a weak position to challenge some of the notions that groups like Islamic State are putting out, and makes them more susceptible to that kind of takfiri, simple good versus evil interpretation that these groups have. So I think those combined, certainly we can say that this crackdown within the country that we've seen, including the banning on the Islamic Renaissance Party, has factored into the vulnerability to join these kind of terrorist organizations.
Okay, thank you. Last comments from you both, and I was hoping you could look into your crystal ball or at least engage in some guesswork here. How damaging is the attack and the alleged involvement of Tajikistan, of Tajik citizens? How damaging is that to Russian-Tajik relations? And do you, considering how much the two countries need each other and the two peoples need each other, do you expect that this will be at least go away and not be an issue soon, or will this hang on for a while? I'll start with you, Edward.
I think certainly we'll see continued societal backlash against Tajik and other Central Asian communities as people are processing, you know, this horrific attack, and obviously attributing blame to kind of all Tajiks. We've already seen viral videos, for example, saying that, you know, claiming that Tajiks are all potential terrorists and they're forming cells in all of our communities. That's a video that was put out and has already had over 2 or 3 million hits on or views on YouTube in Russian influencer. So I think certainly we're going to see continued backlash. I think Russia needs migrants from Central Asia. It has labor shortages as a result of its war in Ukraine. And so I think that will temper the extent to which the government is going to, you know, engage in mass deportations. And so I think that's certainly something, you know, that we may not expect to see, but we'll certainly see increasing societal backlash against Tajiks and other Central Asians in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, thank you. And Salim John, I'll give you the last word then. How damaging is this to Tajik-Russian relations? How long do you think it'll last?
I think it will stay for a long time, especially, you know, reading comments that the Tajiks are saying that we will never forget how the ear of the Tajik was cut, you know. And it depends, of course, very much on what on governments, on the authorities, what they are doing. Just a few minutes ago, we received a report that police raids targeting migrants is going on almost everywhere in Volgograd, Yekaterinburg, Tula, Vladivostok, Ulyanovsk. So it means, so if this will continue coupled with those who have been deported, so of course the relationship will be, at least on the ground, will be not good, because whatever the Russian authorities are doing or saying will increase xenophobic and discriminatory sentiment in the society. Those young kids who are beating migrants being in a group and beating migrants, they will say, yeah, if the police is doing it, so it means we should do that. And also, of course, it depends on how the Tajik government will try to smooth the impact of what happened. But unfortunately, so far, we are not seeing any wise movement for either from Dushanbe or Tajik embassies in Russia. So, it will continue the same way, maybe for some time. But on the relationship, on the state relations level, so they will remain the same. They were always like that, and they will keep it, you know. And of course, Rahmon needs Putin's support, and Putin needs Rahmon. So they need each other. So they will support each other.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Edward. And thank you, Salim John. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mezhlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mezhlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.